I think we can start. Daniel will talk today about constitutive relations for shear flows. And if there's time at the end, I'll give a brief description of the predictions for a shoot flow from just simple kinetic theories. We'll see how it goes.
Okay, so Jerry's not going to predict.
He's going next week. Yeah.
Next week. Yeah. So, I will begin by writing something as blackboard, and then I will use this old-fashioned technology, which is the best way not to have any inconvenience during the calculus. Okay, so the first thing I should do is to precise what kind of granular material I am interested in. And I will say first dense granular material, but dense is perhaps not precise enough to say what I mean. Let us say for spheres, it would mean some volume fraction between the random loose packing and random close packing, which is about point, let us say, 55 and point 64. So this is a domain of concept of convection, which is never part of, let us say, granular cases, which you can deal with the techniques of kinetic theory. And it is not also the domain of, so to say, polar mechanics, which is with a still higher volume fraction of the granular material. So it's something in between. I will address mainly to dry granular materials, but with some incursions into liquid saturated granular material. I will suppress any effect of cohesion. So what I mean by liquid saturated is that all the voids between the grains is occupied by a liquid. It's not only liquid bridges, it's really liquid saturated. So cohesionless, excuse me, no cohesion at all. And last but not the least, flowing granular media. Because there are some specificities of the static granular media, which needs a completely different treatment. So let us say this. Four things are very important. And flowing, in fact, I will mean a shear flows. And two categories of shear flows, mainly confined one and free surface one. So this is a framework on which I will work in. And the main aim is to have unique constitutive equation, a unique set of constitutive equation, to describe all kinds of shear flow. The problem is that this goal is a little bit too ambitious, and so I will be obliged even to make some limitation to that, to it. And these limitations are mainly of two types. First, I will consider only steady and non-homogeneous, fully developed flows. And also, second limitation is that I am interested in the bulk behavior only. That is to say, I will avoid any description of what happens too close to rough boundaries. We will see that there is some specificity also, but I don't want to get involved in that. So mainly steady and the bulk behavior.
Daniel, excuse me, quick question. What do you mean by fully developed? Is it different from steady?
Not really, but sometimes I read in a publication some. In my mind, not.
Fully developed doesn't vary spatially.
Yes, it's steady and rather homogeneous in one direction.
Steady means it doesn't vary with time.
Okay. Steady is for time and fully developed for...
If we have a flow down a chute, it's steady everywhere. You've got a constant mass flux, but it's not fully developed at the top.
At the entrance.
It's only fully developed.
So not fully developed at the entrance.
If it reaches a steady velocity, that'd be vibrational.
So, for instance, if I consider, I am not skillful in drawing, but the flow over a heap where you have some flux which is here going down, I will be maybe on some floor, I will be interested in that part of the flow only, but if you say far from the injection point and far from this point where you will have some flow coming down to zero and so on. So steady would be for a non-time-dependent flux, and fully developed will be in some part of the flow where you have no influence of boundaries or... it's okay? And now it's time to precise the main variables, which I will use for that description for whose constitutive equation. And mainly they are, the number is rather small because if you have only compaction or volume fraction, if you want to find something which is in this range, and you will have the mean, so it's a mean compaction. I acknowledge that in the flow you may have a lot of locally fluctuations, but here this is only the mean compaction. And also the mean velocity, and in fact, two mean velocities, one for the granular material. Since I come from a two-fluid community, which is P for particles, because it is grains, and DF for the fluids. So I have only three variables. Now perhaps you would...
What do you mean by mean velocity? You mean average over the whole flow?
Yes, it's it's a macroscopic description.
Depth average.
Yes, it's an average, yeah.
You know, but not necessarily average over the whole depth of the flow, but just over some small region.
Coarse grain.
Yes, it's coarse grain description, macroscopic description.
Question.
So I know there are...
But not depth average. Not depth average.
Okay. So now, you see that I have only three different variables, and you would say, well, what about granular temperature, for instance? Granular temperature is the average of velocity fluctuation. So the point is that I restricted my description to steady and fully developed flows, for which I have a hunch that any granular temperature would be a function of the local compaction and local velocity gradient. If it is not true, all my theory should be put in garbage. There are some indications that it is true. And now also you could inquire, 10 minutes, what would the grain rotating velocity? Because it is another important parameter. But here again, I am saved by this assumption, but I only want to describe the bulk behavior, because in the bulk, the average angular velocity of the particles will be exactly the same as the local rotation. So you see, these two limitations are, in fact, of invaluable help to reduce the number of pertinent variables. Now,
But when you look at the rotation, there might be also fluctuation amount about the mean.
Sure.
And then there'll be sort of another temperature. You assume it to be just small or comparable to the other temperature, to the velocity temperature.
Well, I can answer you, but this is not a question I am interested in here. All I say, you agree with you, the granular temperature is in fact some combination of velocity, translational velocity fluctuation, and angular velocity fluctuation. So I don't know if you need to distinguish between translational granular temperature and rotational one. All what I say is that these two quantities are supposed to be local function of volume fraction and velocity gradients. Okay, that's all. So, but this is a consequence also. So no velocity fluctuation, no angular velocity fluctuation, and no mean angular velocity. There are some links between these quantities and these three ones. So we have only three quantities. And there are in fact two very different models, very different by their complexity. The first model, so two models of increasing complexity. The first one will be the one I will discuss about, is what can be called a one velocity model. In one velocity model means that the average grain velocity is assumed to be equal to the average fluid velocity, and this common velocity will be denoted by V. And this model, okay, it's no problem that it applies to dry materials because you don't even need VF. Okay, it's a fluid velocity. But it can also apply to liquid saturated media, liquid saturated granular materials, for confined flows. Well, there is not a crystal clear explanation, but you may suppose that a confined flow is a flow like a wet flow or a shoot between two vertical planes. That's to say, the dynamics of the fluid is not so independent from the dynamics of the particles. The main dynamics is due to the presence of these rigid walls. And it is hard to see a situation for confined flows where the fluid velocity, average fluid velocity, is really different from the granular velocity. It's an assumption, but it works better in confined flows than in free surface flows. And so we will see some results in quet, particularly quet flow.
Not sure. I'm still fussing over these V's. What are these V's? Are I should think of these as like V sub V. I should think of this as the average grain velocity over some volumetric region, or how should I think of it? Which is small compared to the. I mean, I should think of this in a normal continuum mechanics sort of framework.
Okay. Yes, it is the. So we have the representative volume, or I don't know what is the exact word for that, some volume where both phases, and you make some average on it.
Okay. I mean,
if you are a little bit more pedantic, you say it's ensemble average.
You could also say that. Okay.
but it's coarse grain averages.
It's still local.
But it's a local.
That's
what I've been
trying to understand. So it's on the level of continuum mechanical description. All these are function of point and time. And the second model, I wish only briefly allude to, is a two fluid model, two velocity, let's just say, models. Two velocity model, and in that case, the two velocities are different, and we applied it mainly to liquid saturated flows.
You mean V sub P is not equal to V sub F?
Oh, I'm sorry. So liquid saturated case and with free surface, or free surface. And Well, the main case where it can be used is in problem of, let us say, erosion problem, and or any problem connected with erosion or geomorphology, if you want. But I have such a restriction here that I can only describe free developed flows, which is of little interest for the study of of free surface and so on. But anyway, so the situation I have in mind here is a kind of situation where you have a very thick sediment at the bottom, a suspension there, and a clear fluid bed. Now this is mainly the situation I am thinking of. So there you will need a two-velocity model, because if you... Well, anyway, you can obtain some results with this assumption, but there, well, these assumptions are quite more questionable in that case. So what is the... Well, okay, just... Now I come back definitely to the one-velocity model. So all what is said after is concerned the one-velocity model.
So is the one-velocity model going to be derivable from the two-velocity model if I assume velocity in the model? Is that, are they...
Maybe we will talk about that at the end, but you will see that you have much more quantities to model in a two-fluid description as compared to the one-fluid description, where you have only one stress tensor to model. While in the two-velocity model, you have also the interface forces and so on. So it's, well, the degree of complexity is enormous difference between one velocity and two velocity. So in fact, what I say is, just let us check what are the prediction obtained with this simple model. If we don't agree with the experiment, then we will move to this much more complex model. But from now on, I speak only about the one-velocity model. And so the, constitutive equation I will develop are intended to describe any shear flow, and by shear flow I distinguish the direction of flow and direction of gradient of flow. I don't need the preparation, the one for the rotation velocity. So it's a this is a sketch of the velocity field, and I will be interested. So this is z. I will call z this axis along the gradient. And what I want to find is, in any cases of shear flow, I want to derive the compaction as a function of z. Well, the x velocity as a function of z, there is only one velocity, and, or gamma naught, which is dx over z, the shear rate. And this I can, to solve my flows, I have only a very simple equation of motion, which is nothing but, well, in my special case, zero, because I have no inertial. Oh, I'm sorry, this is perhaps too low. Okay, I will move there. Oh, you can see her?
Yeah.
Okay. But anyway, this is not. So here, you have just the equation of motion to be solved, and this equation of motion is nothing but this. There is also the weight of the suspension. Okay, so PR is the average pressure, what is usually called the bore pressure of the fluid. This is the stress tensor for the whole mixture, and this is a weight unit volume, and G being the acceleration of gravity. And usually, if I can use one more line there, you have only to be worried by modeling two components of the stress, the shear and the normal pressure, which is to say the normal component of the stress here and the shear going that direction. And
because sigma is an x axis should be constant, steady
cat. Yes, but even except in some curved flow, it does not appear anymore. Just because I have a linear flow with gradient in the perpendicular direction. But I agree with you that in some circumstances, like the wet flow, I will be obliged to introduce two normal stress tensors. One in the radial direction, which would correspond to this one, and one in the azimuthal direction. But except for the wet flow, for all linear flows, what is marvelous is that only two components of stress are left in your equation of motion. But now, this is not the whole work, this is now you should give some model expression for these two components of stress.
So by this you mean unidirectional flows, do you mean flows?
Yeah.
Not one-dimensional flows, unidirectional.
Yes, okay, but all, anyway, we checked in the quad flow. In the quad flow, you need three components, right. Three components, okay? But it seems that I have no crystal clear argument for that. It seems that there is no what is called normal stress differences. I don't know if everyone agrees in the audience, but it seems that nobody has detected, except close to the boundaries. This is why I interest only in the bulk behavior. In the bulk behavior, it seems that no one had noticed normal stress differences.
The simulations of Schuch flows, they say something about anomalous normal stress differences.
You mean
Silberg
in the bulk?
And Grist and...
Okay, so I will have a look over that.
Typically,
they can
be the same as the restitution coefficient, at least in the boundary.
So I should have here, or sigma x, and sigma x eventually.
Now, there's small compared to what you'd expect if you go more subtle.
But we get not bad results, assuming the two normal pressure are the same. Okay? And now comes the... the subject of the talk is the modeling now, but you have seen that what I wanted to make it clear is that with a certain number of assumptions, you simplify considerably the problem, because here it means we have only to devise constitutive equation of two components of the stress in terms of at most three variables. And this was the point up to now. And now I give what we have proposed that has a constitutive equation. Needless to say, this was not the way we wrote it in the first time. It's a kind of trial and error. So let us say at the present time, today, this is the. First, what is called the granular pressure is this. It's the pressure you apply in the direction perpendicular to flow. And if this is made of, so you must express it as a function of these three variables. Well, in fact, because you have separated the role of the pressure here, it happens that this normal component deals with the granular material only, no influence of the fluid. In fact, the only normal stress influence of the fluid is there.
So PF is zero if there's no fluid.
So?
PF is zero.
No,
if there's no fluid.
If you have no fluid, you suppress PF and VF. So I just want to say that this is valid either for dry or liquid saturated granular media. And so it is, it is written first. There are two parts. The one is, so to say, rate independent. That is to say, it will depend not on the velocities, but only on compaction. And the second one will involve the velocity, the gradient velocity, as you may assume. So the first one is written, it involves some function of the compaction, and it is scaled with, well, this is homogeneous to a stress, so it's a kind of stress made out of the density of the particles. It is a true density, it's the density of the material of the particle. Well, g is the size of the particle, and g is the, let us say, the modulus or the intensity of the gravitational acceleration. The problem here is that you...
Capital D?
Oh, it's the size, diameter of a particle. It is very... And second one looks like that. It's rho p p squared, a certain function, again, of phi, times d v over this squared. Or let us call it gamma. And develop was defined here. And then here, so, well, what is to be noticed in that expression is that nowhere appear the elastic properties of the granular materials. There is no Young modulus, and there is no shear modulus. Despite this, you can define some pressure. It's a little bit surprising, yeah?
How does the surface tension depend on density? The surface tension depends on density. What is
surface tension? What is surface tension?
No, this is a part of the total stress. This is what can put the pressure in the z direction. Well, you perfectly know what happens in the kinetic theory. So let us say that the second member is looks like the one you have in kinetic theory. It is proportional to the square of the strain rate. It depends on compaction and so on. But there is a, what is, well, this term is in fact the most surprising. You have a rating dependent term, and what is the role of this term? Is to represent the well, the pressure exerted by the contact, mainly by the contact forces between. But in fact, it is not. It is more. But we can discuss that after, if you want, because there is a lot of things to be said about that term.
How can you introduce g into a constitutive relation? I mean, it ought to be valid whether there's gravity or not.
Yes, good question. So it's well, it's just a matter of scaling, so to say, but it is not a good answer. First, it is a matter of scaling. I can choose my scaling the way I want. All what I don't want is to introduce elastic parameters. Okay, yeah. So I have not a lot of possibilities to build stress. Okay, now also what perhaps I forgot to specify with this dense system is that usually the load with which you obtain such a dense system are very, very low as compared to the Young models. It's only, let us say, this kind of volume fraction, you will get it only using a 1 meter thick layer. While all the aspect of elasticity of the particles would appear only after 1 kilometer thickness system. So I want to discard any coefficient reminiscent of any elastic.
Yes.
Okay. So I have not a lot. So what I mean here is that the order of magnitude of my typical load will be closer to rho gd rather than to the Young models. That's all. In fact, we were led to that expression in case of chute flows, avalanches, and so on. And we were surprised that, okay, even in the quake flow, where gravity has no role at all, it was not so bad as scaling. just because the order of magnitude of the pressure was closer to that. It's a very low stress, this one. But the order of magnitude of usual confining stresses compares with that stress. That's to say, I won't have to introduce numbers which are either 1 million or 10 to the minus 6. That's all.
Then I'm still confused about this. Doesn't it depend on the depth of the layer? And why do you not put in the fact that boundaries may increase the normal
stress? This is a constitutive relation. That is to say, there is no idea of any dependence. Okay, it's whatever is your volume fraction, and at whatever altitude it occurs, it will give you some pressure.
Oh, so it could be that F is not necessarily of order one.
You will see that it varies between zero and infinite.
This will contain the height in the density.
So here I have not yet solved that equation. I cannot give you what is phi of z. But all I say is that I have a one-to-one correspondence between some part of the pressure, general pressure, and the local convection. Now this is the essence of any constitutive relation. After I will solve this equation, but for now I just try to connect the stresses and my three variables which are listed there.
Daniel, the main assumption here is that the temperature is taken out, and it appears that your term GD accounts for temperature because it contains an energy scale. I mean, it's sort of the amount of the gravitation energy that the grain gains by falling its own diameter, yeah?
I would say this is closer to temperature than this one.
Scale-wise, I mean, that's what GD does.
Temperature has to be the limit, it's squared.
Yeah, but it's slightly different. Presumably, if you have some complicated T over gamma dot squared relationship, this is where it would come from in the limit.
But perhaps let me give the a second expression for the shear stress, and maybe you will grasp a little bit the meaning. So here, what is important is that one part exists. Well, this is a flowing material. I remember this. The material is always flowing. I cannot say anything about the static pile of granular material. It is moving, but it may move at some very small velocity gradient. In that case, these terms may happen to be negligible as compared to that one, but I still have non-zero pressure. So two terms, and two functions of the convection I will develop later on. And now, what about the shear stress, because this is the only remaining. Well, we have two things which are, so this is dissipative stress, so anything will be proportional to gamma dot, but with some sign which guarantees that the dissipation is positive. And I will first introduce some Coulomb-like function. So this is only the sign of the gamma dot. But it guarantees that you have the right dissipation. So this is mainly Coulomb-like friction. And it is a very odd constitutive relation in which you relate two components of the stress tensor. It's not usual. I mean, it's the first time I met this in granular material. The fact that you have a relation between two components of stress is not at all obvious. But it was discovered by Coulomb as a way to interpret the existence of, let's say, avalanches above some angle.
But this holds only at the yield condition.
Again, I am in flowing conditions. Coulomb used it as a
only for the yield.
Yeah, only for the yield condition, and you are right to insist on that, because then I will add some more terms, which are written a little bit like this. this one is DOT of phi. The modulus of gamma dot time gamma dot. And finally here, there is the only term which is specifically due to the fluid, and which is a usual viscous-like tensor. And now really you see that, well, these two terms are reminiscent of kinetic theory.
Is that second, is the middle term though, is that actually independent? Can't you get that from redefining the, can you find the first term?
Well, it looks like this one, and in fact, well, I would say it has a chance to be proportional, but not to be equal.
But yeah, but in the first time, you've got the mu phi times sigma zz. So by redefining that, can't you get rid of the mu t phi?
Not exactly. I need a non-zero term here. Really, I need it. I agree with you, I could stop with that and replace sigma zz by this, but what is the problem? I need some extra dissipation besides the Coulombic dissipation. I need an extra dissipation which is linked to the motion. And, okay, so I have a Coulombic-like dissipation with a coefficient which may depend on the convection. But I still have one more type of solid dissipation, which is closer to the kind of dissipation you have in the kinetic theory. I still need two terms. This, not only this one, but also some complementary dissipation.
But I mean, what I'm saying is just purely mathematical. If you add on mu t phi over mu n phi to your mu phi, you cancel out. So it can all be included in the first term to your definition of mu phi.
I mean,
you just have complicated dependence, but it's just an identity.
Take care. And this is the two terms.
Yeah, exactly. That's why there's no additional degree of freedom from the second term.
No, that makes the ratio of the two terms a constant.
No, because I mean that's a function of phi. It doesn't have to be constant. If you define some new function f of phi to equal mu phi plus mu t phi divided by mu n phi, then you get the same thing without the middle term.
What you mean? Okay, you can replace here by these two terms. Keep this term here and add this one and this one. Yes. Okay, I can do that. But just I wanted to insist that when it is written this way, it is sure that you get some more dissipation than the pure Coulombic way. If I was to write it in the way you propose, things would be equivalent, but a little bit less clear. And it's just a matter of showing that you have some more dissipation.
With this way, your mu phi is much more like a Coulomb coefficient.
Yeah. And so this is the only part, and also I should write it in the same color.
So A to F is the fluid viscosity?
Fluid viscosity. And so this is kind of what it is rather well known for. And it's where in suspension, where this is the some kind of effective viscosity, which depends on the volume fraction.
Is correct to say that you need this middle term in the single time to cover the suspension mode with the solid?
I
cannot
answer. I'm sorry, I have not yield things like you propose. It's possible, but
you need a continuous description from the very bottom to the very top. And if you have no dissipation in the solid phase, then everything which comes on top of the solid phase is not covered to solid phase.
But what do you think of Coulombic friction? It's already dissipates.
But not in the solid phase. Because you didn't mediate it.
Okay, maybe we can discuss that afterwards. So this is purely
together, why do you have the viscous turn at all?
Because you are shearing the solid, the liquid also. But the problem is that here, you have the same gamma dot here, while in a two-fluid model, you will have different expression. This would be the gradient of any fluid velocity or any combined velocity, while here is still gradient of particle velocity. So what is the simplification comes here? Gamma dot represents both the shear free shear rate and particle shear rate. But this is an assumption, huh? It's clear. And now I will just precise the transport coefficient. And here again, this was let us say something more. In fact, this would represent some kind of disorder pressure. We will discuss about that later on. It seems that it is not connected to any effect linked to the softness or stiffness of the particles. But here, this term is very specific also. It represents dilatancy effects. That is to say, if you maintain a given volume fraction and increase the shear, you will increase the total confining stress you are obliged to put on the material. And conversely, if you work with a constant confining pressure, then you will be obliged to decrease phi, because I forgot to mention that this is an increasing function, to decrease phi to maintain the whole thing constant. And so this represents dilatancy. This represents, so to say, some kind of disorder pressure. This is the usual Coulombic law. And this is an extra dissipation to, I suppose, to sliding particles and so on. And this is the dissipative stress linked to the fluid motion in the pores of the left by the body. So now we have introduced, you see that we have a very limited range of volume fraction. And in fact, it happens that all these four functions of the volume fraction, in fact, depend on what is called the reduced compaction, and which is nothing but phi minus the loosest random packing, random loose packing, over the difference between random close packing minus random loose packing. Or anyway, this is the two values which bounds the range of available compaction. So you see, it's a kind of, so to say, order parameter, but I don't like this word because it is misleading. But this is a quantity which is varying from 0 to 1 when you are 0, when you are on the lower bound, and 1 when you are when you reach the upper bound. And all this transport coefficient will be function of of this reduced compaction. And so, for the results to be presented later on, we used a function f of y, which is proportional, there is a coefficient, which is mainly, which has a logarithmic divergence when phi goes to 1, that is to say, when I come close to the random close packing. The two functions, mu n and mu t, are proportional to each other, and they are diverging like 1 minus phi squared, which is a very strong divergence, which is reminiscent of the one that Jerry proposed a few years ago. It's the strongest one, because after we used a coefficient of friction, we assumed that it was a constant, that is to say, it has no very special values either at the random loose or random close. And finally, eta f, well, the effective friction coefficient is proportional to, well, it's a diverging function, but it diverges less than these two ones. Only as one over. So needless to say that These are you can choose your own expression if you want. But I think that here you have almost all what you can imagine about dissipation or dilatancy and so on. The problem is to give explicit expression for these four transport functions, and this is the choice we have made.
Can you motivate more the choice for F? I don't understand why that one.
Well, as I told you, it's a disorder pressure. So to say, when you have in any shear flow, you are in a situation as to explore many different microstates. It's a shear flow, in fact, or a steady shear flow, is a convenient way to represent tappings or any cyclic loading and so on. So your flowing grains are can explore many microstates, and this pressure here, so this one, let us call it sigma zz disorder. In my mind, it would be related to the entropy, if you can define an entropy of disorder corresponding to all your different microstates. What this quantity would be minus this. And one of the simplest models which gives you such an entropy is a lattice cell model. Lattice gates or lattice cell? When you separate your space into various cells and you put one particle or zero. And so here, if you remember, it's a lattice gate, so S of phi, remember something like this. When you take the derivative, you get some kind of pressure, which is in logarithm of phi 1 minus phi, and this is a reminiscent of this term. But I do not guarantee anything about that logarithmic divergence. It seems that it explains many experimental facts. So it would be curious, because it would be the first time that this kind of Edouard measure has some consequence of the on the experiment. No? Okay, so just a few words before going to the but it's not, this will not be long. Okay, so you see that if I the way I have written my stress tensor is amounts to say that I have already chosen some scaling which is to measure any length by diameter of the particles, which is to measure any mass by rho p v free or dimensional space, and the time by some kind of a gravitational time, which is this one. And now all my quantities pertaining to the grains, if you scale it by these quantities, we have no non-dimensional number. Now, if the fluid comes into play, you have two, so it means that the velocity will be scaled with GD, let us say any stress will be scaled as rho p, gd, and so on. So, but there is no adimensional number. See, only when you introduce a fluid, you introduce two adimensional number, which is the ratio, which is not a surprise, and some kind of adimensional fluid viscosity, which is this one. So you have two more non-dimensional number when you introduce the separated fluid. So it's this all what I want to say, and now, instead of drawing something, we'll just give some. Thank you. So this first transparency, just to mention that this is a joint work with Christophe Josson and Pierre-Yves Lagrée. Remember also the kind of interface diagram with the volume fraction and eventually dry or liquid saturating. We were interested in the dry very normal material in this regime and in the liquid saturated in these two regimes. So here just a reminder of what we said. So well, the ingredients mainly were the disorder pressure, the latency effect, solid friction, rate dependent friction. This is the way. Well, in fact, this is close to what has been coined as the frictional collisional model. But in fact, there is no, well, characteristics of the collisional party are very specific. There are no influence in particular of the restitution coefficient. It does not appear anywhere. But it looks like a collisional stress. Okay, so the transport coefficient has already been given. So what are the results? First, for the flow down a heap, that's to say you have a hopper and you constitute some heap behind, then so you impose the flux, QV, and then the system will arrange to some angle. But if the system chooses its own angle depending on the amount of grains that you impose on the heap. Yeah? And well, so the velocity is rather interesting because it includes here an exponential decrease there, that is to say deep inside the heap, then something which looks like a linear velocity profile, and finally there is some, okay, I don't have these clear effect that early or not, but some here zero velocity gradient when the system adjusts at the surface. Yeah. So this is for the velocity, it's rather complex, but it looks like what was found experimentally. And just what is to be noticed is that there is a minimum angle, well, theta is, it would be this angle. But all the systems are evolving between two values of this angle, a minimal one where the flux is zero, that is to say if I have a very small flux, the angle on the heap will be that minimum value. And if I increase this value, then the angle will increase. And what happens is that the thickness also increases. So you can cope, even if the angle varies not a lot, you can cope with the large increase of the
Daniel, what is R?
Well, it's a typical thickness level. I don't know how to define it precisely because there is a exponential tail. But anyway, this is the if you calculate the average velocity, the product of U by R gives you approximately the flux. Okay.
Is the surface of such a heap flat?
I suppose this was a two-dimensional problem, which is not at all the condition of an experiment. In an experiment, there will be some conical things. But remember also that the flux of our cone is not fully developed.
But I mean, you could simply make the experiment. You take an outflow of another material and investigate the shape of the cone.
Usually people make the experiments between two vertical plates. The only problem is that is to decide what is the role of the friction on these two vertical plates. But anyway, we find, you know, you have two vertical glassy plates. You can see through them, and you see some velocity field which looks like that.
This is flat.
What Oh yes, between two vertical plates, yes, the surface is flat, yes, it is.
Would it also work with a viscous fluid, it's funny?
Between Honey, I think. No, okay, with Honey's experiments will be clearer on a flow than an incline. I don't think if you can make a conical shape with Honey, oh yes, suddenly.
I ask myself, what makes systems different from a viscous fluid? I mean, I assume a viscous fluid you cannot make a conical shape. It would have something special.
Yeah, yeah.
What makes it so different from Honey?
It's in the consecutive rows you have this Coulombic friction, and this Coulombic friction is responsible for at least for this angle, for the existence of a non-zero angle for zero flux.
That's a different one. With Honey you have a flat surface on which a pile of Honey is stood. Here you have in fact a cone.
I would say that at least this one would go to zero.
Yeah.
At least there are, of course, some more difference. Okay, and perhaps just a last one. So you remember, what is to be remembered is that for each angle theta, there is a flux. When you for the heat, there is a heat flux which is connected to that angle. And so let us consider now what is called the shoot flow, that is to say you have a rough incline there and there with different inclination. But you imposed only a single value of the flux. What happens? But what happens is depending on the comparison between the flux you impose and the flux a heat would produce with the same angle. Suppose you have a very large angle, then you can assume that your flux that you impose here on the incline is certainly much less than the flux which would flow down a heap with the same angle. And then we can prove that it's a prediction of the model that you have some diagonal light profile, which is a free and hard profile. I don't remember exactly well what it is, but you see it's a kind of thing with zero velocity gradient on the surface. Now if you reduce this angle, still maintaining the same value for the flux, then you will have a more linear flux. So the velocity profile will be quasi-linear, except for something which happens to the free surface. And now when you still reduce the angle at such a value, that Q is larger than the flow which would get down from a heap, then something happens. Is that your you cannot expect that you can get a flux which is larger than the heat flux with the same angle. So what the system does, it will develop some dead zone here, that is to say a zone where the grains are not moving, so as to mimic the existence of a heap. You develop a head zone, a fixed zone, no motion, just to develop the flow around a larger angle. So it's not clear here, but this slope here is larger than this one, and you have almost zero velocity at the bottom. So this is a kind of prediction you can make with the model, but I think I will stop there. Well, there are also results for quite flow and so on.
Can you calculate these analytically then? Sorry, can you calculate analytically the velocity profiles from these equations? Or do you have to solve them numerically?
Well, in the limit of very, very small depth, that is to say for a very, very small Q, not exactly flat, because you would obtain a flat profile if you were moving on a very smooth surface. Then in that case, yes. In a rough surface, well, you have a friction which is developed by the rough incline, and then your velocity has a tendency to slow down close to the incline. So that the case you are referring to would happen in case of a smooth surface.
In the case of the shoot flow, eventually, as you increase the angle, it becomes unstable, yeah?
Yes, but to say at least you, yeah, that's right.
And how does this instability reflect in your fluid equations? There's no solution?
There is a square of a term which is equal to something which is negative. And so you have this is a mathematical reason, but...
So you have a bend of solution.
You have a bend of solution.
Okay, so,
thanks.
So, what
is the permanent rate? Are you going to say anything about the two fluid model?
Yes, something a little... in two fluid model, you have not one quantity to give modeling expression, but three different ones. You must model two stress tensor of particles. Okay, you can adopt the same model as the one for dry materials. You have to model this the fluid stress. Here again, not a lot of problems. You just use this Newtonian with effective viscosity. But the most annoying thing is to model the interface force. So you are sure that you have a drag force, okay? But you may have a lot of different forces. And or like John told us yesterday, you may have shear-induced diffusion forces and so on. And this has some influence also on the fluid shear stress. You have much more quantities to model in a two-fluid version of this model. But you cannot escape to that if you want to describe erosion problem or...
Also, am I correct that your model really described flow only between the volume fraction between random loose packing and random close packing?
Yes, I will restrict to that. Yes, it's a very small range, but because of the large variation of the transport coefficient,
yes,
you have a very specific behavior.
So, is the statement that granular flow cannot be fully developed steady outside those?
I know, but I will be obliged to change my conservative relation, that's all. No, I can describe the granular gas, but this is...
We will have to choose different Fi and mu.
I know, no, Fi is very specific, and mu of Fi, Coulomb friction, and this disorder pressure are very specific of this small range.
So you have to be modified.
Yeah, the others are not. That is to say, the function mu n and mu t have their corresponding correspondence in the Dilute case, but not Coulomb friction and not the disorder pressure. These are very specific to this small range between 0.55 and 0.65.
I think Qumran suggested that we should break for a few minutes, but what can you tell us what you would still like to do this morning? And in particular, the thing that I'm most interested in is seeing a real comparison with experiment. I mean, a quantitative comparison with experiment. And I don't really appreciate yet. You have a lot of adjustable functions in there, and I don't really have a way of judging whether how much insight is really added by this model, and how much is a set of phenomenological equations that can be fitted to data, any data. So I don't know. That's where I am right now.
Okay.
Is this something you want to get into after if we take a break, or
not this time?
This is pretty much
not this time, but I can.
Pretty much what you want.
What I want to show was just if you just take the usual kinetic theory expressions and do all the calculations, what do you predict? Mm-hmm. Okay, so that kinetic theory calculation has no adjustable parameters.
Uh-huh.
But it has some assumptions.
I mean, so is it fair to say that what that you can use this to describe experiments, but
well, in this case,
it's not unique.
Yeah. Well, you can take a look at it and judge.
Yeah.
Okay. Certain things it predicts, certain things it doesn't.
So you're going to present some slides. Okay. Mm-hmm.
I have to get up, like, they wanted to be at the airport at 4:15. So then I can ride, I can go to sleep.
So,
probably to fall asleep or something.
I mean, the two-fluid model is essentially interpenetrating continuum model applied to the
There's actually a stronger tradition here, right, in that if the scaling is a function of that, but I mean, the phi is still universal. It's still universal. So you can compare across different periods.
The one for example, in this case, you have a time scale that comes from Gamma, but you also have a time scale here that comes from this
confined field.
So you have three fluids.
So you
don't have to more than you do. So these things come from that. You have this real dependent variance also. So I think you know, you should think of it as just plot.
Coefficients and function in case of dry material before expanding to liquid saturated material media. So so like Jerry said,
Is it supposed to be for this program?
Yeah, because it's a logical
way.
It's a logical way.
Actually, the company wouldn't let me get it.
And also, it's a way of understanding why you would beg not to
provide. Well, I'm wearing nice clothes. I have the undergraduate sunglasses on and I'm dressed nicely today.
Exponential profile and so on.
A shame.
Perpetuating the image of graduate students
is a well-defined function of.
Well, if they pay us more, then we wouldn't have to give up.
That's pretty
much it's a first step. So I must reduce the number of variables to a minimum.
Well, it becomes another.
If I am interested in non-generic situation, then I would give up. And equations for the temperature and also for the angular velocity of the particles and so on, but it could be less. So I would like to already have several things in the simplest case with the minimum number of values.
So you could ask yourself whether that's more important or taking account of the distinction between the two phases is more important also. Mm-hmm. And once you do all those things, man, the model is going to be unbelievable.
Thank you.
See you. I mean, the temperature is.
Hey, Chris.
Mm-hmm. As well, it's pretty low in the interior, but.
Sort of, you know, light in the area, too.
You put it right in there.
Well,
I'm not too great.
I might. I have a review article written by.
So you can derive from the.
It is only 11 or 10?
Yeah. You can derive from the two fluid model where you have the, this.
Yeah.
Is it reduced to the one fluid model and you take some appropriate?
Muffin tops are.
In other words, is the two fluid model a general? Is this a specific case of your two fluid model?
I've seen that same thing.
Well, what is specific is the dense part. The suspension part, you know it very well.
No.
There is nothing new, but.
No, but what I'm asking is whether. If you go to the more general model, the two fluid model, is it reduced to this model under.
Oh, yes. When, in fact, every time the friction force between the phases will be high enough to reduce the velocity difference to a very small value when you can use the one velocity model. It's a matter of interaction between the two phases.
Okay, so I'll just. Okay, I'll just do the kinetic theory calculation for this particular case, and what this does not have is any of those functions that represent statics. You can get coefficients exactly in this case for the dynamic parts, the parts that depend upon the strain rate. Okay, but it doesn't have any of those coefficients that are independent of strain rate. Okay. So I'll just go through briefly some of the assumptions that are made there. So in kinetic theory, you solve this Boltzmann equation. And that's for the velocity distribution in within a volume in phase space. And it has this time-dependent term. And then there are these convective terms, which represent the velocity through this volume in phase space. And there's this additional term here, which appears because you're writing the system, the equation, in terms of the fluctuating velocity, rather than the particle velocity itself. You've taken out the mean velocity at that particular location. Okay? And that basically represents this initial term. And it appears because if a particle moves from one location to the other, its absolute velocity has not changed, but the fluctuating velocity has changed simply because the mean velocity has changed. Okay? So that is the blue term. And this is the collision integral. Okay? I'll come to that a little later. So in the absence of gradients at equilibrium in classical calculation for conservative systems, you'd say that the collisional contribution is equal to zero, the collision rate of the distribution function is zero, and you get a Maxwell Boltzmann distribution. For non-equilibrium systems, you do an expansion about this. So you assume that F naught is the Maxwell Boltzmann distribution, the leading order distribution. And then you calculate the corrections to this due to the gradients of the system, and then you calculate the first correction. Okay? And then from that you get the stresses. So this is for a conservative system. Okay? If you take inelastic particles, this term is non-zero even under steady shear. Okay? And that has to be equal to the collision integral. Okay? The collision integral is non-zero in this case because of inelastic collisions. Okay? And so you can once again expand in the perturbation expansion, provided that this parameter, right, En is a normal coefficient restitution, is close to 1. Okay, so that is a small parameter. You do an expansion, and an energy balance equation will tell you that this term, the blue term on the left-hand side, is sort of epsilon n is smaller than the right-hand side. Okay, so the leading approximation. Yeah.
So you're actually expanding around the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution.
You're expanding about the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. The parameter is different. It's not the ratio of length scales, it's the departure from elastic collision. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you can crank out the expansion systematically. So you need to conserve energy in the leading approximation, which means that you're specifically restricted to certain types of collisions. For smooth particles, you're restricted to collisions where the coefficient of restitution is close to 1, so that this parameter epsilon n is small. Energy is exactly conserved for epsilon n equal to 0. Okay. For rough particles, you have to take the change in the velocity at the point of contact. Okay? So the relative velocity at the point of contact, you resolve it into two components. Okay? Energy is conserved, the normal velocity is exactly reversed, and the tangential velocity remains unchanged. So that's a smooth collision. Energy is also conserved, the normal velocity is reversed, and the tangential velocity is also reversed. So that is a perfectly rough collision. And in both cases, the equilibrium solution is the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. And you can perturb about that. So you have two parameters. One is a normal Gaussian restitution, other is a tangential Gaussian restitution. And energy is concerned, this should be 1. Epsilon 8 equals 1, and E is equal to plus or minus 1. So I have these parameters for expansion, epsilon n, and epsilon n and epsilon 3, in this case, for rough inelastic particles. So just,
what is the notation, KK?
K is the length joining the centers of the particles.
The notation KK.
KK is the tensor notation. I is the identity tensor. So it just tells you that the relative velocity at the point of contact, okay, after a collision, is equal to minus ET times the value before a collision. And if ET is equal to minus 1, it's unchanged. Okay, so that is smooth. It's equal to plus 1, it's reversed, which is wrong. The usual Boltzmann collision integral is this one. Okay. It contains a gain term due to this term here and a loss term due to this one. And in the Enskog approximation, you change it in such a way that you put in a fair distribution function here. And that fair distribution function just accounts for the fact that particles have a finite volume. Okay, so if they have a finite volume, then the volume available for the second particle to move around decreases. And so this fair distribution function at contact increases. Okay? And different forms have been used for this fair distribution function. At low and moderate densities, what is usually used is what's called the Kahn-Hahn-Stahl form, in which increases the real expansion in the low density regime. But it goes to a finite value of closed packing. Okay. So it's in error as you go to closed packing. You can also use other forms that actually diverge in closed packing. Okay. So we can specify distribution functions of this type. They do not go to the correct limit in the dilute limit, but they are more accurate as you go near closed packing. And I'll do calculations for both of these forms and I'll show you what the results are.
The right form is also used for a sandwich,
huh? Yeah, there is people that use it. Okay. You can actually combine the two and get something that diverges currently and so on. The other thing that is not included in the Boltzmann equation is correlated collisions. You assume molecular chaos. And it's known that these correlated collisions give you extended to the three halves term, the constitutive relation. In correlated collisions are basically because two particles just collide with other particles and collide back again. Okay, and so then velocity before the collision are correlated. Okay. And this is sort of related to the velocity autocorrelation function, which has a long time tail, which was a C power minus 3 class. For shared systems, this effect turns out to be not that important because the long time tail and the autocorrelation function actually goes to C power minus 3 in the shared system. And a simple way to look at that is that if you put a shear and have an original system, this particle is going to travel longer than this particle, okay, because of the superposed velocities, and that describes correlations beyond a certain length. Okay, so the moments of the Boltzmann equation are of two types. One is what I call the slow, that is mass, momentum, and energy, which are conserved in collisions. And then there are other fast moments with decay over time scales comparable to the collision time. And the idea is that if you put a perturbation to one of the slow moments, it's not going to decay in a homogeneous system because energy is conserved in a collision. So if you inject some additional energy into the system, it cannot decay. Okay. So if you put a perturbation with wavelength k, then these modes decay with a growth rate which is proportional to some power of k, okay, for the slow modes. And they decay with on the scale of the collision time for the fast mode. So you need to worry only about the slow or conserved modes in this case. Okay. And these are the hydrodynamic modes of an inelastic system. There are two transverse momenta. There is a longitudinal momentum, which these are the sound modes, and then there's a thermal energy mode. The reason I'm going to this is because for a dispersive system, energy is not conserved. Okay. So there's a source of energy and then there's dissipation of energy, which means that energy should be a non-conserved mode. Okay. It should be a fast mode in the system. Okay. You can get that by balancing out the rate of conduction of energy and the rate of dissipation of energy. Okay? And you get a length scale out of these two. The rate of conduction goes as the just the thermal diffusion coefficient divided by the length square. Okay? Thermal diffusion coefficient goes as t power half times the mean free path. And then there's a rate of dissipation of energy, which is basically due to inelastic collisions. Okay? And you balance out the two, you get this conduction length, which goes as the mean free path divided by 1 minus e to the power of half. Okay? So if e is close to 1, this is large compared to the mean free path. If e becomes order 1, then this becomes of the same magnitude as the mean free path. Okay. So this is the distance over which energy can be conducted. Okay. So you'd expect that if you had a real system, right, energy will be conducted from the boundaries only over a distance of the order of LC. Okay. And for these distances, you have to consider energy as a conserved mode and write equations for it. Okay. In the bulk of the flow, the energy, the distance is large compared to the conduction length, which means that energy is a fast mode, it's a non-conserved mode. And it's determined locally by a balance between source and dissipation. Okay. So that's the origin of saying that the temperature is determined locally by a balance between from the strain to itself, okay, rather than being conducted across the system. Okay. Over these distances, you have to consider energy as a conserved mode, and you have to solve the boundary layer equation for that. But in the bulk, you don't need to worry about energy as a conserved mode, and it's just determined locally by a balance between source and dissipation. Angular momentum is not conserved. Okay, it's a non-conserved mode. Angular momentum in a collision is conserved about the point of contact. It is not conserved about the centers of the particles. Okay? So angular momentum is not a conserved mode. In a reference frame located at the particle center, and the decay length for this is roughly the same as the mean free path.
What's the reason?
Well, angular momentum is conserved about the point of contact. The angular momentum about the center of the particle is different.
Talking about angular momentum in individual collisions?
In individual collisions.
Because it's not isolated?
The angular momentum.
Please explain.
If you had two particles which collided and they had some particular angular momentum, right? The angular momentum of the particle about this location, that is the center, the point of contact, okay, is going to be equal to this plus r cross the distance. Okay. The distance is in opposite directions on both sides. Okay, so what will actually be conserved is omega, consider this as omega 1 and omega 2. What is actually conserved in collision is omega 1 minus omega 2. Okay, is conserved. Because the direction of the line joining the centers is in opposite senses on both sides. Okay. Whereas, as far as the linear momentum is concerned, the sum of the two velocities remains the same after collision, or the velocity of the center of the mass. But for angular momentum, if you choose its sense from the center of the particle, the difference is actually conserved.
Differences of angular velocities.
Angular velocities. Yeah. Well, I'm assuming the momentum of inertia is the same for both particles.
No torque at the point of contact.
There's no torque at the point of contact. But the angular momentum about the particle centers is not a conserved variable. So the local angular momentum is going to be determined from the anti-symmetric part of the local rate of deformation tensor. Okay, so it'll be half the local vorticity for in the leading approximation and then there are corrections. Okay. So this is constitutive relations. Just to show you that we get all these functions explicitly, okay, the pressure, the viscosity, as well as these are all the Burnett coefficients. Okay. S is the symmetric part of the rate of deformation tensor, G is the anti-symmetric part, and G is the isotropic part. Okay. And you can get these, they turn out to be different whether you're considering smooth particles, rough particles, and
sorry, could you comment on the anti-symmetric part of the stress tensor?
The stress tensor for smooth particles is symmetric.
But for rough?
For rough particles, there is an anti-symmetric part. And that comes about because of the convective derivative of the local angular velocity vector, mean angular velocity vector. It turns out to be zero for a simple shear flow. But there is an anti-symmetric part. If you put in a simple shear flow in this case, you end up getting zero.
So can you write it down in terms of the local angular velocity of the particles? Or?
The stress tensor.
The anti-symmetric part?
Yeah, because the local angular velocity is related to the antisymmetric part of the rate of deformation tensor. Right. It's half the vorticity. Vorticity is equal to epsilon I, the antisymmetric tensor dotted with the antisymmetric part of the rate of deformation tensor. So you get out of that. So the idea is that we get all the components of this, all the components of the shear and all the stresses. So for this specific application, it's sigma xy, I'm using x and y here. X is the direction, y is the gradient direction, and I put my origin here simply because this is the free surface. And v sigma xy by dy is minus rho d sin theta, and yy is rho d cos theta. So the ratio is equal to minus tan theta. And just from dimensional analysis, both of these are proportional to the straight x squared with known coefficients. Okay. So what that's telling you is that tan theta is what we call the ratio of a function only of density. And so if you know the form of this function, then phi has to be a constant across the flow okay, for a given angle of inclination. Okay. And this function will basically specify what that value is. Okay. So it's independent of height in this approximation. And that's actually what is seen in simulations of Schulte rule. So once you know what the value of the volume fraction is, then you can get all the other quantities. So tan theta is equal to the viscosity times the rate of the strain rate divided by the pressure. And the viscosity has a p bar mark in it, and pressure has a p in it. So you get tan theta goes as epsilon n in this case, because tau dot is or epsilon n smaller than p bar dot. But if you include the next higher order terms in the approximation, you get this Burnett approximation, which contains normal stress differences in the expression for tan theta. So the way you do it is that you first get the volume fraction from the dependence of tan theta on this right-hand side, which is only a function of volume fraction. And then from that you get the strain rate. Straight away you can see the strain rate versus y bar top. And the viscosity depends upon this, is proportional to this pair distribution function. So if the pair distribution function diverges at close backing, then the strain rate increases continuously from zero at close backing, if this diverges. If it does not diverge, it increases discontinuously. Okay, it has a finite value at this point. Okay, so it's sensitive to that coefficient. So what are the kinds of results that you get? And plotting here the volume fraction versus tan theta. And what would you expect? You'd expect that somehow as I increase the angle of inclination from the point at which flow inception of flow. So as I increase theta, the volume should decrease. It should go up. Okay. It could go up in a couple of ways. Either it could go up like this. So this would be the minimum angle and this would be the maximum. Or it could have some maximum angle somewhere in between. Okay. You would not expect behaviors like this, which means that as I increase the angle of inclination, the system actually becomes, as I decrease the angle of inclination, the system expands. Okay, so as I decrease the angle of inclination, the system expands.
You know, I'm confused about what this is really plotting. You were fixing a volume fraction and asking about the angle that the flow would have to satisfy to be steady?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So at a given volume fraction, what is the angle the flow would have to be steady? Okay. Because the angle of inclination depends only upon the volume fraction, because it was the ratio of two functions, which are functions only of the volume fraction. Okay. I mean, I could have plot the other way, I could plot angle against tan theta, but that sort of goes from one limit to the other.
Did you say at the beginning, was still outside of that, did you say what the range of densities that's appropriate for this theory? Is this a binary collision?
This is a binary
kinetic theory regime. Yeah. Yeah. So, and is that appropriate for densities as high as the ones that are plotted here? Or is it maybe the theory works better than it should? Or what would you say about that?
I'm trying to say the theory works better than it should. But I justified it somewhere in between by trying to say that correlated collisions are not important for shared systems.
Okay. So you think it's, at least when you're not too close to phi c, it should be
Yeah. Okay, so from my perspective, I classify flows into two types. That is, everyone does it. They classify it to slow and rapid flows. For me, rapid flows are ones that satisfy the Wagner law. Okay, that is that the stress goes as straight rate square. If the stress goes as straight rate square, it implies that there is no other time scale in the problem, no other material time scale that is affecting the system. Okay? So therefore, it should be able to represent all particle interactions by dimensionless parameters. Because there's no material time scale that's affecting the problem. Okay? If you can represent it by just dimensionless parameters, the simplest model is an inelastic collision model. Okay? So that was sort of the justification for that. Okay? And you can actually do the calculations. You know, you include a more sophisticated force law for, let's say, you know, with the spring and dashboard, Hertzian contacts and stuff. Put in the parameters and see what is the intrinsic time scale as compared to the inverse of the strain rate. Okay? Turns out for glass beads, you need to go to very, very high shear rates before you see that interference between the two time scales. Okay, I didn't put all of that in because it's supposed to be a short talk. So that was the justification.
I understand.
Okay. So these are kinds of things you'd expect. You know, these are kinds of things that have been proposed in literature, game models, which clearly shouldn't. Okay. So this is what you get for inclined plane flow, Navier-Stokes approximation, okay, angle of volume fraction versus tan theta, okay, for smooth particles, okay, and I show the Navier-Stokes approximation for rough, smooth, partially rough, clearly not angular. Sir?
Well, when you speak of Navier-Stokes approximations, what are you saying about?
I'm truncating
boundary conditions and all sorts of other things. I don't know, the name Navier-Stokes doesn't describe a uniform, but a unique
The advantage of this is that in the bulk of the flow, right, the only conserved variables are the density and the three components of the velocity. Okay, so energy is not conserved. That means energy transients are restricted to boundary layers near the top and bottom. Okay, so I don't have to specify boundary conditions as far as temperature is concerned. Okay, I do have to specify boundary conditions for velocity. Okay. But everything that I'm doing here depends only upon the strain rate, not upon the velocity. Okay? So I can go ahead, calculate the strain rate, okay? And then when I need to do the velocity, then I'll have to worry about whether there is no superficial boundary condition there. So I can do the strain rate calculation without worrying about boundary conditions at all. Okay? Except for one at the top, which I have to assume the strain rate is zero at the top because there's nothing above it. Okay, this is what you do when you do the Burnett approximation for smooth particles. Okay. You can see it sort of decreases slowly over here, okay, and then it increases again. Clearly, once again, not satisfactory. I have changed epsilon n squared, which is supposed to be a small parameter, all the way from 0.05 to 0.5. Okay. But if you do it for a rough particle, okay, plugged on an inclined plane, you can see that theta increases with phi for epsilon n squared greater than about 0.192. Okay, so for 0.2 and above, blue and above, you get something that increases in the position. Okay. And this for a rough particle calculation. And this was what I call the partially rough particle. It's a hybrid collision model between smooth and rough. So it's rough if the collision is frontal, and it's smooth if it's a very grazing collision. And once again, you see that you get fairly good agreement
between
fairly reasonable results for an increase and theta. Right.
You mean it looks qualitative?
It looks qualitatively good. The point here is that a model without any friction in it is able to predict that there is an angle at which there is inception of flow. Okay, and there's an angle beyond which you cannot have steady flow. There's no friction in this model at all. It's just kind of here. Yeah.
Have you tried to put numbers that will be comparable with some of the experiments that are available?
So here I've plotted the angles. Okay. So if you have something like this, you have a minimum angle and a maximum angle. This is the angle at close packing. This is the angle at loose packing. Okay. And you can see in this case, the minimum angle is always lower than the angle at close by, okay, for this system. there's no smooth particles. If you do the same thing for rough particles, if the minimum angle is very close to the close back angle, for epsilon, very small. But beyond that point, it goes to roughly a constant. Okay? That is, the angle at which there is small dissection at close back.
My question was different.
Yeah.
Have you put number of restitution?
So this is about 19 degrees.
Maybe I should mess.
So it's about 18.6 degrees in the experiments. So it predicts that you have an angle that is roughly independent of the coefficients of restitution if they are sufficiently large, okay? The angle for inception of flow.
Okay, yeah. And that's probably in the experiment they are reasonably large.
They're reasonably, yeah. They're roughly a constant. Okay. And this angle is about 19.2 here and some of 18.6 or something in the experiments.
And the other angle?
The other angle is increasing almost linearly with the coefficient of restitution. This is not closed. I'm not too worried about that because this just tells you that there is an angle beyond which you cannot have an equilibrium solution. Okay. Whether this is stable or not is something that has to be decided by further calculation.
So you're primarily interested from the transition from steady to stable flow.
Yeah.
From no flow to stable flow.
Yeah. Okay. And kinetic theory without any friction models, etc., predicts that you will get that. You have to be careful here because I reported only the second term in the perturbation expansion.
I mean, the conventional wisdom was that kinetic theory was not capable of describing this transition.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying with the Burnett approximation, which is a more sophisticated handling, it appears to be consistent.
Yeah.
Well, there is an argument by Goldrush, who says that, I don't remember the more details, but he said that the Burnett order is insufficient. If you want to go to the Burnett order, you have to take at least some terms in super Burnett order. Otherwise, it's not so
necessary. But that's the argument that I made earlier. This is the super Burnett order. Because they're in unshared systems. Because of these correlations and correlations.
That is, it dissipates in your shared system.
Yeah, tensor being subdominant in shared systems. This is partially enough to get roughly the same results.
So to interpret, what you're saying is that when one accounts properly for this ring collisions, or correlation orders, then you can predict this transition reasonably.
Yeah, to the extent you see. Okay. What it does not predict is that x stop and x start and stop. Okay. That x stop is related to the thickness of the boundary layer, the temperature boundary layer I told you at the bottom. Okay. So you have to solve that boundary layer calculation to get those things. Okay. But as far as the steady flow is concerned, if you consider temperature to be a non-conserved variable and do the calculations as usual, you don't get the correct behavior. Okay, thanks.
How about the velocity versus height profile?
Velocity versus height profile in this calculation goes as y^3/2. That is observed in simulation.
So it is Bagnold.
It is Bagnold. It's limited to Bagnold simply because I've assumed that strain is only.
It's the same assumption.
What is interesting here is that the kinds of normal stress differences you create are also seen in simulations. Okay. But from this calculation, I have all components of the stress tensor, so I can predict normal stress differences.
Okay. How does that look as you increase density?
It depends on which model you use. Okay. It's sensitive to model. So for certain models, it turns out to be positive, and certain models, it turns out to be negative. What it does not have, so what does it not have? It does not have the dependence of the pair distribution function on the strain rate. So that's the major weakness. Okay. And it does not take into account correlated collisions, the effect of that on the maybe stops per. Yeah.
Can you
If you want to look at stream flows that are very dilute, say if you're shaking a vessel or something, or if you wanted to actually sort out the boundary conditions on the top of your flows, you'd have to look at the streaming case. So can you then approximate the Boltzmann equation by doing perturbation where there's no collisions? So you initially have ballistic trajectory from the input. So how does that work then? Can you still take moments? Does this affect? You can still gravity if you then expect an asymmetric probability distribution.
It's an asymmetric probability distribution. You can take moments, but the moments turn out to be there is something similar for my PhD actually. The moments turn out to be the Kurtosis turns out to go to eccentric space proportions in the sense that the fourth moment divided by the second moment is square. But you can do the distribution function.
But that doesn't mean that there is power law?
No, when you go far enough away, it decays exponentially. It just means that it's singular near the origin.
Oh, it's okay.
It's the other
one. Yeah.
It's singular near the origin.
Yeah. Okay. We have spoken about the velocity profile.
Yeah.
What about the angular velocity profile? What are your results?
The angular velocity in this case is always half the local vorticity in the linear approximation because angular velocity is not a complete function. And that is seen in simulations also.
Okay.